I learned something these past few years. My listeners are probably bigger gluttons for punishment than I am. So much so that when we did an episode about some of the worst sketches in the history of Saturday Night Live, you managed to make it one of the most listened to non-contest and non-special episodes of Telehell that we've had in the almost 5 years that we've been doing this show. I would say thank you, and I sincerely do. But if a collection of worsts on a venerable television institution was what helped propel the numbers, I hate to wonder if I'm a sadist or a masochist for trying to capture lightning in a bottle a second time. You want more pain?
You've got it.
Largely because I really have no choice down here but to remain in pain, whether I like it or not. But this time around, I don't just want to talk about any sketches from any era of the show. After all, SNL is very close to marking its 50th year on the air, and you know we only have time for a handful of sketches to bash out of a seemingly endless selection. With that said, this year marks another anniversary of sorts, for it was 30 years ago this fall that I became a regular viewer and life and death long fan of SNL. As it happens, I became a fan during what is arguably the single worst season of the show they would ever have.
I am so excited to be hosting the first show of the 20th season of Saturday Night Live.
And now, use as directed. This is Telehell.
A lot of people tend to say that certain seasons are bad for a number of reasons. But there's always something close by to help defend it. Season 6's excuse in 1980 was that it was the first new cast after the hallowed originals left, and yes, in spite of some awful things happening there, I still feel that that season was treated unfairly over the years. Season 11's excuse in 1985 was that Lorne Michaels and company were trying to get back on their feet again after being away for such a long time. Season 20 of SNL should have had no excuse for sucking as bad as it did. It was an anniversary season. Many of the people on the show were on the cusp of becoming superstars. And it was still a place where people tuned in on a Saturday night. But then, about midway through the season, an article popped up in New York Magazine that pretty much said what we either feared to hear or were too blind to notice. That not all was well in Studio 8H due to widespread creative burnout. A burnout that ironically shone like a neon light as the season progressed. Of course, having certain cast members rebel over how bad things were didn't help either, but we'll get to that part in a second. We'll reference the New York article from time to time during this show, but the overall reason why we're here is that, yes, all of the sketches that we're going to be talking about today all hail from the show's 20th season on the air, which, in spite of very minimal silver linings, is frequently seen by casual and diehard fans and foes alike as the absolute worst season of all time. For those who are unfamiliar with what we did the last time, a quick reminder of the rules. First, this is not a countdown. These are just sketches off the top of my head that I absolutely hated. This is really going to be formatted more like our Big Game Hall of Shame shows in that we're not going to go in any particular order for these, but I do want to save something truly awful for the end. And in a year like this, that's saying a lot. If we miss anything patently obvious, please let us know, and I'll be sure to leave some room for the inevitable Volume 3. Next, no sketches with recurring characters, and no monologues. Monologues because those are too boring to criticize, and no characters because that would be too much of a crutch. Next, the reminder that all the sketches that I pick are subjective and personal. If any of you out there happen to enjoy any of the sketches that I'm about to list, I won't hold it against you. These are just sketches that I happen to dislike immensely, and I'm ready to agree to disagree on some of these, so please be sure to take this with a grain of salt. Next, just so we get our nine circles out of the way, a reminder that the vast quantity of sketches, let alone episodes of the show, stretch out from hell to, well, the other place, giving comedy fans and foes alike plenty of chances to become gluttons for punishment. The fact that we're talking about SNL sketches that I personally hated makes us a lock for wrath. And some of the sketches we cover may contain trace amounts of either lustful or, on rare occasions, violent content. But that's in the most rudimentary of sense. And finally, considering the subject matter, I'm going to try really hard not to make this collection top-heavy with sketches that all come from a single episode. If that were the case, I'd just be reviewing one individual episode of SNL in its entirety, and there's plenty of podcasts out there that already do that. Isn't that right, friend of the show and co-host of the That Week in SNL podcast, Andrew Dick?
No!
See? There's no such thing as too much of a good thing. Either way, I will do my damnedest to limit things to just one bad sketch per episode, because I want us all to live long enough to see SNL's eventual 100th anniversary in 2075. With all of that in mind, it's time once again to embark on a Saturday night sequel, even worse than Blues Brothers 2000.
Live from New York, it's Saturday night!
Induction number one.
With a season like this, it's tempting to want to dive right into the cream of the crap. But if we were to start things off with something universally reviled and then build from there, that's a lot of weight and also a lot of pressure to carry. So let's start things off with something that's mildly subtle in comparison to the rest of the entries. For our first entry, the host is Courtney Cox, and the alleged joke in this sketch is that nobody seems to know what the word sarcasm means.
Listen, we need answers on this stuff by the end of the day.
Oh, well, can't you guys figure it out? I'm really backed up here.
Wait, we need a decision on the new office manager.
Well, I don't care. Hire anyone.
The premise is that a company needs to hire an employee to be their new office manager. The search has gone on for far too long when, at the peak of frustration, Michael McKean... Yes, Laverne and Shirley, this is Spinal Tap, Mr. Green and Clue, Chuck McGill from Better Call Saul did a season of this show as a cast member, Michael McKean, says this.
I don't care. As far as I'm concerned, you can hire Charles Manson.
And we're off and running.
Well, we're having big problems.
What with?
Well, getting Charles Manson out of jail, for one.
What?
Yeah, for your information, he's still in prison, but since you want him...
Hey, you guys aren't seriously trying to hire Charles Manson, are you? I was just...
Oh, please don't tell you that you changed your mind. Do not tell me that.
You have no idea how much trouble this has been. Turns out the guy's a serious criminal.
And before we go any further, let me just very quickly play a good example of a sarcastic statement taken too literally.
There's still the little matter of the whereabouts of your wife.
I'm right here.
Oh, I see. Then everything is wrapped up in a neat little package. Really, I mean that. Sorry if it sounded sarcastic.
We now resume further desecration of sarcastic statements already in progress.
I can't believe you're doing this!
Listen, we're gonna hire Charles Manson. I'm just telling you, it's an unbelievable sweat, so I hope it's worth it.
And this goes on.
Bad news, Manson has fallen through.
Yep, not gonna happen.
And on.
Good news, Manson's coming.
Yeah, it turns out it was just a money thing.
Yeah, he wasn't cheap, but you wanted him.
I never wanted Manson.
And on and on for a few minutes. Until we get to the punchline of Adam Sandler playing Manson.
Oh, listen, Charlie, did you get the new toner for the laser printer?
Yeah, I did. I shopped around. Office Depot had the best prices, so I ordered a couple cases.
Hey, good thinking. Anything else?
Yeah. I'm your mother's icebox, man! I don't break the laws, I make the laws! I make the laws from here.
Which I'm just gonna say is no more of an extension of Sandler at his most... and whose performance is probably an insult to an SNL writing legend who could probably do a far more superior impression of the psychopath. Take it away, Saul Goodman.
I'm sad your children. I'm a stain all out there in the world. I'm not just locked up. You're locked up in the prison. I'm free. I'm floating around and looking around. I like it up here.
The best way I could describe this sketch was that it was a fart. It's in the air for a moment... It lingers for a while. Depending on the ingredients, it's unpleasant, but it eventually goes away. Compared to some of the other entries here, a fart might just be one of the most pleasant things to sit through in comparison. because the stench is only going to get worse from here.
Looks like Charles is really working out. Lucky for you, I thought of hiring him.
Excuse me, I believe that was my idea.
I assume you're kidding. You were totally against it.
I assume nothing.
It's Saturday Night Live.
Induction number two.
When you watch as much SNL as I have over the years, you tend to notice little patterns and nuances here and there that an average viewer might not notice on the surface, but some diehard fans may see as a warning sign that something may be going wrong. This next sketch is the, I guess you could say, beneficiary of two patterns. First, the fact that anniversary seasons, usually the ones that end in a multiple of five, tend to focus more on resting on their laurels than putting in actual authentic effort. The other pattern is if you can detect a sketch's punchline within a few seconds, you might as well take a bathroom break. Case in point, one that aired on the show's season premiere in September of 1994. Steve Martin was on hand to kick things off with a time-tested comedy trope. Trying to do a simple task, yet blowing it in multiple but wacky ways. In this case, an advertising agency attempts to refresh the image of a new candy bar containing nuts. Two ad men, played by long-running cast member Kevin Nealon, and Chris, I actually had a career doing funny things, why was I slung it on SNL, Elliot, coming up with a way to increase awareness of this candy bar. First attempt.
Nut-rific! Nut-rific! Nut-rific!
It's not very good.
Yes!
Very nice.
Wonderful.
Second attempt.
One, two, three, four.
Nut-rific! 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 Nut-rific!
It does not taste good.
Yeah, well, that's even worse than before. Yeah. Before, it sounds like it does not taste good.
Exactly.
Okay, look. I have been writing commercial jingles for quite some time now. There are those who would suggest that I'm rather good at that job, hence the 1992 Mercury Sabre parked outside. I have made some money in this business.
Rumor has it this character is still driving around in that Mercury Sabre. Third attempt with a misfire.
Outrageous! Nut-tastic! More nuts! More nuts!
It's just got more nuts.
Yes!
That is not your jingle. That was something we were working on for the Creedmoor Psychiatric Institute.
Yeah.
The first and probably only actual laugh that the sketch got. What a shame it had to be at the expense of the mentally ill. Then, the actual third attempt.
Nut-rific! 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 Nut-rific!
It's not something you'd want to put in your mouth.
Okay, that's it. We've heard enough. I mean, this isn't working out here.
At which point, all here breaks loose, and Tim Meadows steps in to handle things personally. Final attempt.
Nut-rific! 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 Nut-rific!
The candy that's made by nutsies.
Nut-rific!
Yep. Sig Heils and all. They go there. And for this sketch to be part of the season premiere is not exactly the best way to set the tone for what's to come. Bonus trivia. A few years ago, comedian Jay Moore, who was a two-year featured player on the show, wrote a memoir about his time there, and how he heard a rumor that Steve Martin's trademark gray hair was actually a gray hair piece. And if you watch the very end of the sketch very carefully, you could see Jay looking somewhat distracted while trying to find some kind of indication that Steve's hair was fake. I know it's not really the best piece of trivia to end this sketch on, but then again, the trivia is better than the sketch itself. Moving on.
It's Saturday Night Live!
Induction number three.
This next one hurts me to say, especially since this next person that we're going to be talking about was probably the X factor into why I started watching the show regularly. Full disclosure, the first show I ever watched was one from October of 94 when Dana Carvey hosted. No, he's not the X factor, but he is in the top five. And having seen it rerun a couple of times and knowing what I know now about the show overall, it was a natural jumping-off point. Not just thanks to Carvey, but Also, Chris Farley's performance in one particular shining moment that, to be honest, just reeled me in.
Why, thank you, Pepper Boy! That's the perfect amount of pepper! Bravo!
I cannot, for the life of me, explain the science, or the physics, or the chemical reactions involved. But the second I heard Farley bellow his joy for fresh pepper, it made me a fan of both him and the show for the rest of my life. Unfortunately, I didn't quite realize at that point that this was Farley on the downswing of his tenure on the show. I also didn't quite realize that there was an old saying about Farley that was just being established at that point, that he didn't play different characters, he played the same character at different volumes. By the midpoint of season 20, even though he still gave it all he got, the volume was so high that people were actually anticipating their ears to bleed whenever Farley appeared on the screen. With all due respect. This sketch, from when Jeff Daniels hosted in 1995, may have been the point of no return. Though, in Farley's defense, the sketch itself seemed pretty weak from the first 20 seconds.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to McKeesport Dinner Theater. I'm your host, Bob McAdoo. Tonight, we present a diabolical mystery entitled Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Murder, Catch a Killer in the Mansion of Flirter.
You have Harvard graduates in the writer's room. And that was the best title you could come up with. Good to know. Moving on. The sketch seems pretty innocuous enough, with various cast members introducing themselves in their roles, slash making their only contributions to the sketch, and in some cases, the episode entirely.
What happened to the lights?
It's probably just a fuse, folks. We should go look for the fuse box. All right, everybody split up. Each check a room. Alone.
I'll stay here in the event our elusive host makes an appearance.
And then, we unleash the beast.
What? Who are you?
Say goodbye, Mr. Albright.
What? Ow! 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 Why are you hitting me? Who are you? Your fists are crushing my face! Ow! Your punches are... Dirty my bones, snapping! You're killing me!
1 minute, 37 seconds later.
Oh! No! Oh, don't let me die in a puddle of my own urine!
1 eternity later.
Hey, am I crazy or is this death scene going on like forever?
Oh, sorry, I wasn't paying attention. The death scene. Oh my God, is this still going on?
And before we continue, as lazy as this sketch was, the one good thing I'll say about it is this line after Jeff Daniels breaks a vase over Farley's head.
My God! My head just popped like a ripe melon!
30 fucking years later, and that line read is still rattling around in the area where there used to be gray matter in my head. No doubt having shrunk after watching this, and continuing to shrink.
I want you guys to know it's not me, the one who's milking it out there. He just won't die.
I knew it. I knew this murder scene was going on longer than usual. It's not my imagination. I wasn't sure, but now I am.
You know what I think it is? His parents were in the audience tonight.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. Let's go out there and let's just pull the plug on this thing. Come
yes.
on.
Which leads us to Chris Elliott, who, again, had a perfectly good career when he joined the show this year, for reasons, as he does his best to put this sketch out of its misery.
And hey, fat stuff. Your parents said they'd meet you at Shakey's, the pizza place out on Route 19, if everyone wants to go. They did say, if you could, to please not bring up the play. Okay? All right, kids, knock yourselves out. The play's the thing.
Stupid.
Okay.
Elliott uttering the word stupid the way that he did probably spoke more for what the audience thought than what he thought. And I concur. So let's move on from this before my head pops like a ripe melon.
Stupid.
It's Saturday Night Live.
Induction number 4.
Picture, if you will, March of 1995. The aforementioned New York Magazine hit piece is unleashed to show off just how flawed SNL had become by that point. And with many verified sources corroborating the evidence, this left the show in a wounded state leading up to that weekend's show. They just had to prove, not just to themselves or to the press, but to the entire world, that everything was fine from New York. And that the show was just as funny in 1995 as it was in 1975. Unfortunately...
Ladies and gentlemen, Paul Reiser!
Now, don't get me wrong. Paul Reiser was, and still very much is, a much vaunted figure in the world of stand-up comedy. And it's practically in SNL's DNA to have comedians host the show from time to time, especially those who happen to be the stars of hit programs on the same network. Paul Reiser is certainly no exception, since Mad About You was part of NBC's revitalization as the must-see TV network. Of course, just because a performer works well on one TV show doesn't mean he's going to fit in on all the other shows. The fact that he, an established comedian, is on a show like this, an established comedy show, and completely fails to deliver on the one tradecraft that he's known for is embarrassing enough. And yet, among all the sketches that took place during this war crime, including a cold open about Newt Gingrich's LGBTQ half-sister with horribly dated gay humor...
Candace, Marta, can we get a picture of you two kissing?
I'm sorry, I think that would be inappropriate. But you could take a picture of both of us kissing Newt. Marta? Yeah?
Hey, just a second! Get the hell off
a virtually laugh-free monologue...
When you hail a cab, you stick out your hand, and a whole car stops. This is great, just because of your hand. Hand, car. Hand, car.
A sketch about inferior superheroes filling in for Superman.
How has the boomerang ever helped save anyone?
Because you throw it, and it comes back to you.
A 5-minute screed against women's sports.
Why do we always get selected to cover the women's tournament?
What, are we like being punished or something? What is the story here?
Well, yeah, in a way. But listen, I'll talk to you about this after, okay? And 5, 4, 3, 2...
Another sketch in an advertising agency, this time where executives are squeamish over an interracial kiss.
What, was the kiss longer that time?
No.
Same kiss.
It seems so much longer, no. Bob.
No.
A Stuart Smalley sketch that... unfortunately telegraphs Chris Farley's troubles with addiction.
Mike, you are drunk.
It's St. Patrick's Day!
Okay, well, that's no excuse. You are a cameraman for a public access cable TV show. That is a sacred trust.
A bizarre Mad About You slash Aliens hybrid that should have stopped at the title sequence.
Hey, sweetie, what do you think of this sweater?
What do you mean? Is that a good or a bad? Because frankly, I can't tell when you talk to me like that.
A talk show sketch with exactly half of one joke.
To hear a celebrity like Paul Reiser here, who's proud of the fact that he's only slept with 2 or 3 women in his entire life.
And oh. I think we all...
A subpar attempt at invoking the spirit of Abbott and Costello.
Hey, we were just wondering why you call this restaurant One Brother.
Because I have one brother.
Yeah, but, I mean, shouldn't it be called Two Brothers, then, you know, because there's two of you?
And a sketch that was 100% plagiarized.
When I was a lad, my dad used to take me out into the harbor to fish for mackerel. It was a long boat. Now get the hell out! And don't come back until you're ready to drink!
Yeah. Jeez, all right, calm down.
Which reminds me, a late tag for fraud on behalf of Jay Moore, no matter how much he copped up to it years later. But believe it or not, that's not the sketch I wanted to talk about here. This is an honest list, and I wanted to talk about a sketch from this show that completely sucked on its own merits. So much so that I'm gonna let the select lowlights from the offending sketch speak for itself.
What's in the triple-decker club here?
Triple-decker club's lettuce, mayonnaise, chicken.
What else besides the chicken, though?
Lettuce, mayonnaise.
Could you add bacon to that?
To add bacon?
Mm-hmm.
Nico?
No,
it is what it is.
Much, much, much later.
Now the 4-cheese pizza. Ah. That doesn't have any of that Greek goat cheese in it, does it?
No. Yes, mozzarella, Romano, mozzarella, and then there's more mozzarella.
That's really only 2 cheeses.
No, there's four cheese. Mozzarella, Romano, mozzarella, and then some more mozzarella.
Ah, oh, yeah,
you're an
idiot.
Okay, four cheese.
Yeah.
3 days later.
Now, I'm assuming that your double cheeseburger is just one burger patty?
Yes, double cheese, one burger, yes.
Does that come with any cheese?
No cheese.
Can I get cheese?
You want to put the cheese on it? Nico?
No.
No, it is what it is. And from where you are sitting, you see the two brothers. It's Nico and me.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It's just two. You see two, not one. So we should call the restaurant. Should be two brothers.
Right. Yeah.
Two brothers.
Yeah.
We're talking. Maybe we should do it. We should change the name. Nico?
No.
No. It is what it is. It is.
One brother. A sketch from an episode of SNL so radioactive that I truly feel that the show's actual highlight, aside from Annie Lennox as the musical guest and Norm Macdonald saving the fucking day on Weekend Update, was this promotional ad for the hotel where the show quarantined their hosts in the 90s.
Hotel accommodations for most guests of Saturday Night Live furnished by Paramount.
That was the highlight of this episode.
And folks, this is only the halfway point. All of you, if you don't drink, this would be a good time to start. It's only going to get worse from here.
After the break.
Introducing the all-new Lexon Paradox. This remarkable automobile is the synthesis of the work of two teams of Lexon engineers. Team A was asked to decrease the size of Lexon's most popular model, while Team B searched for ways to make it bigger. While one team made Paradox the most expensive car in the world, another made it the most affordable. One team gave it incredible stopping power. The other gave it no brakes of any kind. One team was asked to give the Paradox four doors. Another designed it to have only two, while still another gave it six doors. And a final team, one gigantic all-purpose door.
One big door.
And while one team gave the Paradox dual airbags, another designed it to shatter on impact, throwing passengers up to 300 yards.
Very, very dangerous.
The new Paradox. The best car money can buy.
Or is it the worst?
This week on Telehell's Premium Content of the Damned.
Welcome to the all-new Bowling for Dollars.
Yeah, Bowling for Dollars was back, but there's one problem.
I have not received a dime.
There's bowling, but where are the dollars?
You never got your money.
No.
Why wouldn't we be expected to be paid?
This aired on TV, yet John never got his money.
The only way to listen to Telehell's premium content of The Damned is by becoming a patron at patreon.com/telehellpodcast. For just a few bucks a month, you can listen to our premium content and get some swag along the way. Once again, that's patreon.com/telehellpodcast. And now, back to this week's torture.
It's Saturday Night Live!
Induction number 5.
To recap, the first episode of SNL I ever saw was the one that Dana Carvey hosted back in October of 1994. October 22nd, to be exact. The next episode of the show was to air on November 12th, meaning that there would be 2 weeks of reruns. One of which was a Halloween special featuring some vintage content that I'd be watching for the first time, including some stuff from the hallowed first 5 years of the show, as well as a rerun of that season's premiere episode with Steve Martin. In spite of how shaky that show was, the combination of that and the Halloween clip show was more than enough to get me primed for the next week of new content. I was officially hooked on SNL after 3 weeks, blissfully thinking, hey, maybe the show's like this all the time. You poor, dumb, naive bastard.
He was a writer that the writers, actors, and even the producer feared.
And in this business, it's better sometimes to be feared than loved. But we're not afraid of him anymore, because he's dead. He's dead, and he went straight to hell. Just a visit, the couple people he had.
Just so there's no confusion here, this is not the next moment that we're inducting. Rather, we're using this moment here as a point of context. It was during the week of this show's broadcast that original head writer and semi-regular performer Michael O'Donohue died suddenly from a brain hemorrhage. As this was happening, Lorne Michaels' first son would be born, with some complications, but thankfully he came out of it healthy. And because both of these events happened to be taking place in the same hospital, that's where the show wound up convening that week for script writing and rehearsals. Or so the book, Live from New York, by Jim Miller and the late Tom Shales, has led me to believe all these years. Regardless, the production of this episode, to be hosted by Sarah Jessica Parker after original host Juliette Lewis backed out at the last minute, was decidedly fraught with stress and tension in the air. And it shows, particularly here.
Where could we be? I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore. We must be over the rainbow.
What's more wasteful than an unfunny sketch with phoned-in performances and a massive set that must have cost NBC several thousands of dollars to make? How about an unfunny, phoned-in, expensive-looking sketch where pretty much everybody involved is at the end of their collective ropes? Up to, and including, Janeane Garofalo, who, back in the early and mid-90s, was one of the biggest rising stars on the stand-up comedy circuit, and had already made a name for herself in sketch comedy thanks to appearing on the brilliant but canceled Ben Stiller show in 1992. Garofalo really did want to be on SNL and lobbied hard to get there, only to find out that once she got in, it was the biggest case of be careful what you wish for since Robert Oppenheimer harnessed the power of the atom for weaponry.
Come out, everyone! Don't be afraid!
Look, you can keep singing, but we're not coming out.
Hit the road!
I don't know what language they speak in Kansas, but we don't like you. Comprende?
I better go, good witch, but thank you. Oh, no, my dear one. Come out, everyone! Where are your little munchkin manners? It's Dorothy from Kansas!
Nobody cares!
This was a sketch that, according to memoirs by one-season wonder Laura Keitlinger, could recall Garofalo being in tears over appearing in this sketch, fearing that doing so would mark the end of her career. Considering just how mean-spirited everybody was in this sketch, it wouldn't surprise me in the least if the entirety of this sketch was less acting and more the cast telegraphing their own feelings working on the show at the moment.
Okay, Munchkins, I'm not asking to meet you per se, but I just need a place to stay for the night. I'm a little tired from the tornado, and I'd really appreciate it if I could stay here.
Hit the road.
No, look, it's just one night. You won't even know that I'm here.
Hit the road.
Come on, please.
Hit the yellow brick road.
Wizard of Ass!
But for all the damage this sketch did to people's psyches, in particular to Janeane Garofalo's, shockingly, this was not the straw that broke the hipster's back.
It's Saturday Night Live!
Induction number 6.
For this next sketch, I can technically sit back and relax while other people do the heavy lifting. I still gotta read it, though, because it's from the New York Magazine article that we mentioned earlier, doing a better job of a play-by-play than I ever could. So, if you don't mind, I quote, host George Foreman is rehearsing his role as Uncle Joe, a shy wedding guest who is being tormented by Kevin Nealon, playing the wedding reception's smarmy MC. Nealon goads the reluctant Foreman to making a toast.
Uncle Joe!
We found our man! Come on up.
Okay, you got me. Okay, Warren and Denise, I love the both of you, so good luck. How's that?
Hey, sounds good to me. Let's hear it for Uncle Joe!
Nealon wheedles Foreman into singing a song.
Listen, I'm serious. I don't want to sing.
Okay, Uncle Joe. Left side say Uncle, right side say Joe. Ready?
Uncle Joe! Uncle Joe! Uncle Joe!
Now here he is, the one, the only!
The 5-minute sketch isn't particularly complicated or particularly funny. Yet, after an hour of rehearsal, Neelan is still stumbling over his lines. Then, Neelan, in what was then a record 9th season at SNL, accidentally steps in front of Foreman, blocking the camera and stalling yet another take. There's a metallic clatter as the stagehand knocks lighting poles to the floor. 5 actors, 15 extras, and 4 musicians sit silently, waiting for the disembodied voice of Dave Wilson, the show's director for most of its 2-decade run, to give them instructions. Potbelly technicians jam chocolate chip cookies into their mouths. A couple of SNL writers waiting for Uncle Joe to finish so they can rehearse their own bit snicker that the sketch should be called Uncle Slow. The article then continues to say, quote, "Standing in the darkness just beyond the set lights is a glum Janine Garofalo. For the first 3 months of the season, Garofalo has largely been stuck in dull secondary wife and girlfriend roles. In Uncle Joe, she's a waitress," with a single line near the end of the sketch, and the scene keeps breaking down before reaching her cue. Finally, it's time for Garofalo to walk up to Foreman, tray of fake cocktails in hand, saying,
"Uncle Joe, I don't know you and you don't know me, but I work here and your niece is getting very upset."
"Oh, will you look at that?"
2 or 3 more takes and she's done. She dashes off to her dressing room. Later, a close friend who visited Garofalo in her hotel room after the Foreman show says, "You know how depressed she is? She's in her bed right now. She's just lying there. She's absolutely destroyed as a person. The show has beaten the shit out of her." End quote. Holy shit, that is a lot of misery to dispense for just one unfunny sketch. And that was just in rehearsals. And it's usually after the dress rehearsal show on the night of broadcast when certain sketches get cut for various reasons. Either time constraints, need to be rewritten, or it just flat out bombed during rehearsal. The dress rehearsal audience who sat through this sketch was clearly breathing in nitrous oxide, because when this aired live, no pulse could be found.
Celebrate! Come on, celebrate! That's all I know.
Big round of applause for Uncle Joe!
Maybe if you tried to sing it with bagpipes, it could work. Uncle Joe and the Wizard of Oz. 2 sketches this season so awful that it shattered the spirit of Janine Garofalo. And considering millions of people always thought of her as the real-life version of the cartoon Daria, that's saying a lot.
"I don't have low self-esteem. It's a mistake. I have low esteem for everyone else."
But not so much that she would eventually do something about it. And with that, we do need to jump quickly to the end of the story for a little explanation. In the Tom Shales Jim Miller book Live from New York, Garofalo could be quoted in saying, "The place has undergone an exorcism since I left." Well, of course it has. She supplied the holy water. Whenever an already established comic personality tries to become a part of SNL's crumbling infrastructure, one of the following things can happen. Either you're only there for a year, but you make the most of your time, like those who participated in the 1984 season, or you're there for a year, but then you decide to leave because you only think that you're better than everybody else.
"Good evening, I'm Chevy Chase."
Or you're there for half a year and you simply leave because you actually have the brains and the courage to point out that the smiles on everybody's face is all a part of a decaying facade. And that's exactly what Garofalo did. Yes, her publicly protesting how bad the show was became a black eye that she inflicted. But if you think about it, if she didn't bring the volatility of the show to people's attention, particularly to those in the media, the overhaul that would happen the following season would never have happened, and just about anything that basic cable would find brilliant would move to NBC at 11:30. Much like a certain slip of the tongue triggered a chain of events that ultimately saved the show the first time in 1981.
"Oh man, it's the first time I've ever been shot in my life. I'd like to know who fucked did it."
Garofalo's lamenting on poor writing, poor work ethics, a boys' club mentality in overdrive, occasional homophobia, and the all-around sense that nobody cares pretty much accomplished the same thing. For her efforts, Let's just call her both the hero and the anti-hero for season 20. The mirror with a crack that Lorne and NBC had to force themselves to look in. And also, I'd be lying if I didn't mention that Janeane Garofalo was probably one of my first celebrity crushes. What can I say? I have a thing for tart tongue, sharp wit, brown eye brunettes. I'm only human. Anyway, I've rambled on this sketch in particular long enough. Let's go to something darker.
It's Saturday Night Live!
Induction number 7.
So, content warning. We're about to go down a really dark path with this next sketch. So much so that it would not surprise me in the least if Detectives Benson and Stabler were to come barging down here after I talk about it. Yes, ladies and gentle demons, we're going there. Whereas all the sketches I spoke about so far were considered bad for simply being not funny and also lazily written, this one particularly was a moment where even the most ardent of fans of the show think, the fuck?
Hi, Dr. Henderson. Hi, Mrs. Henderson. So did you have a good time?
Yes. Yes, we did have a good time.
In a sketch called The Doctor and the Babysitter, from the same episode that brought you the Charles Manson sketch, by the way, Chris Elliott is ultimately seen having his way with Mark McKinney as a female teenage babysitter, which, by premise itself, is enough for Chris Hansen's spidey sense to start tingling.
Well, anyway, I like track at school, and sure. I mean, I guess I like school, except they make us wear this stupid uniform.
Oh, I wouldn't call it stupid.
Oh, yeah, it's really stupid. It's like every day we have to wear the same tie and the same blouse and the same kilt and the same tights. I mean, the only time that we're allowed to take it off is like when we're in the shower.
And the bonus crazy part is that this is not the first time that Mark McKinney played this character in particular. Hey, we said no recurring characters, just not on SNL. So, gotta do another tangent for a second here. You can't mention SNL in the early to mid-90s without almost immediately comparing it to another Lorne Michaels sketch show classic. The much-beloved, yet somehow underrated, Kids in the Hall. A show that, sad to admit, it's taken me my entire life and death to see what the fuss was about. Now, to be fair, I didn't have cable growing up, so I missed out on the shows in round-the-clock reruns on Comedy Central. I did get the complete series a few years ago, and despite the heat around here melting the discs, I finally understood why the show was as popular as it was some 35 years later, even with a revival series on Prime Video. On some days, Kids in the Hall is what SNL wishes it could be, with fewer restrictions. I know it seems like I'm veering completely off topic, but the reason for even bringing them up at all is because Mark McKinney played this same character during the run of that show, and it was largely inoffensive.
I like him. He's mysterious.
All the girls want to know, who's the cutest boy on death row?
But here?
Why are we stopping?
You know what? I gotta rest the carburetor in this car. And okay. You know what I'm also gonna do? I'm gonna turn off the heat and the lights there just to save the battery.
But won't we get cold?
Well, we would get cold if we didn't take advantage of our own body heat.
Oh, you mean like in the Arctic?
That's right, Melanie. Just like in the Arctic.
Yeah, we're studying that next semester.
This being the first year that I actively watched the show, this sketch was also the first time that I actually felt uncomfortable watching the show. Though, incidentally, the discomfort for me was really more for watching a guy making a move on a guy in drag, and keep in mind, I was only 10 years old when I first saw the sketch. I hated it for different reasons back then.
Not that there's anything wrong with that!
But then, you get to the real reason why this sketch makes my flesh crawl. Regardless of how old one is when they watch the sketch, or whatever it is that may be the hot button, this sketch should never have happened simply on the basis that a sketch about pedophilia should have been more vilified than lampooned. Not to get on a soapbox, but even if the show had already done so a number of times in its earlier years...
And if I'm not mistaken, Ruffy was going to bury his bone in your backyard.
Yeah!
And much later on, through the decades...
And for the most evil invention in the world contest, I invented a child molesting robot.
And yet, somehow, those sketches and many more like them were far more endearing than this one.
Look, if you're thirsty, would you like some refreshments? There's something in the glove compartment there.
Oh my God, is that Zima?
That?
But getting back to the other point, where was the comedy here? By the end of the sketch, when Elliot finally has his way with McKinney, they slam cut to a scene of Elliot getting locked up in jail, and then... this happens.
I'd do it again! I swear to the Lord above, given the chance, I would do it again! Do you hear me, society? I'd do it again! Again! And again! And again! Again!
And that's it. That's the punchline of the sketch. An actual execution in a prison's electric chair would have been a bigger payoff than what was executed here. Hell, they did that in 1980 with Gilbert Gottfried, and that sketch was abundantly funnier.
Mom!
Son! Sit up straight! Sit up straight!
Live from New York! It's Saturday night!
And yet, as appalling as this... and the other six sketches that we've talked about so far were, at least it's easy to see why they were bad. For our final sketch today, though, this one may go down in history as the televised equivalent of a Rubik's Cube in terms of inscrutability. But after what we just sat through, this is a decidedly lighter note to end things on.
Induction number 8.
When people are asked about what made season 20 of SNL so vilified, they often point to five particular shows where even the most ardent of fans start to realize that something may be going horribly wrong in Studio 8H without having to read any of the tell-all articles about how bad things really are. Those shows are ones that we already mentioned, hosted by the likes of George Foreman, Sarah Jessica Parker, Paul Reiser, and Deion Sanders. And for those keeping track, we already mentioned a sketch from that episode last year, and even I'm not that cruel as to subject you to a second sketch from that show. You're welcome, by the way. And then there was Bob Saget's episode in May of 1995, which, unlike the other four shows, actually had sketches that, despite how bad they were, you could tell that there was, at the very least, a glint of effort. Or, at most, one or two funny jokes to be seen if you dug deep enough and if you washed enough dirt off of them. But nothing else. All of that in mind, I actually have to tread lightly with this next one because of just how much they use an actual song here. But first, the actual song.
Close your eyes, make a wish, and blow out the candlelight.
This is Boys to Men, the legendary a cappella group who redefined what it meant to master the art of the slow jam, and are probably the most responsible for pregnancies in the mid-1990s thanks to said slow jams getting most of us in the mood. Their 1994 hit, I'll Make Love to You in particular, may be the most responsible for said pregnancies happening. But again, I digress. Point is, the song is a masterpiece and stands the test of time some 30 years later, as does the group itself. Considering it's SNL's primary responsibility week after week to lampoon anything and everything that was a part of the cultural zeitgeist, it wasn't like they were forbidden to do a parody of the song. What they decided to do with it, however, remains, to this day, possibly to the end of time, and even when time itself starts up all over again, remains one of the most baffling things the show would ever do.
Close your eyes, make a wish, and blow out the candlelight. For tonight is just your night. We're gonna celebrate all through the night. Pour the wine, light the fire. Girl, your wish is my command.
This is not to say that the show can't have its fair share of serious sketches or ones where performances are played 100% completely straight, just as long as there's even a little hint of comic relief in there somewhere. Because no matter what kind of sketch it is, SNL is, first and foremost, a comedy show. If you're not making the crowd laugh, you're not doing your job. I know this seems like a slow burn setup to get to the point, and I promise there is one, but you do see where I'm coming from here, right? This, like 90% of the series, is available on the Internet Archive, and I actually encourage you to watch this anomaly from May 6, 1995, and ask yourself the same questions that I did. What was the joke supposed to be in this sketch? Was it the fact that this boys-to-men group was 75% white guys? Was it the fact that the band's actual name in the credits was Boys to Men 2? Was it the fact that SNL had no idea how to cash in on something that was obviously popular? Or were they stuck doing something that maybe couldn't be parodied? Simply put, why even waste the audience's time with this? Leave it to the SNL fan community online to try to play detective for me. After this show, I strongly recommend visiting a place called OneSNLAday.com, where a legend simply known as Stooge reviewed every single episode of the show up to the 43rd season, when Stooge retired from the SNL review circuit. Under the Bob Saget episode, and this sketch in particular, his thoughts on it were, quote, 2 minutes into this sketch, and I'm sitting here staring at my screen, wondering what the bloody hell I'm watching. What in the world is the point of this sketch? Where's the joke? Why are they singing the whole I'll Make Love to You song with no comedic twist? Why are three white guys playing three of the four Boys to Men members? Is that the joke? If so, why isn't it funny? So many questions, so little laughs, end quote. Stooge then goes on to mention various technical snafus, like the quote-unquote sketch fading out too early or the camera lingering on too long on certain cast members. Comments on the show below the review try to figure this out too. One person came very close to figuring it out. A user named Ian, I'm assuming it's friend of the show Ian Firmiglitch or maybe just some random guy named Ian, says, quote, as far as I can tell, the joke of the Boys to Men sketch is that it's a spoof of romantic music videos with campy embellishments of various cliches that might appear in such a video. If they'd create an original group instead of being Boys to Men and also done an original song instead of a cover, that intent might have come across more clearly because, as it is, it's just confusing. Assuming that was the intent, of course. If you're paying attention, cast members Morwenna Banks ends up with Jay Moore at the end, and Molly Shannon ends up with Bob Saget, despite the fact that it should have been the other way around based on the pictures they were using and crying over in their bedrooms. It was probably a genuine blooper, since this sketch, like so much of this season, feels pretty sloppily executed. The premise could have been funny, but it seems like they put in a minimal amount of effort, end quote. Okay, that may be the most solid excuse slash defense for this sketch that I've heard in the 30 years since I first saw this, but considering SNL has spoofed things like this in the past, proves that there should have been a template to follow that worked. Show of hands, how many of you out there remember a sketch from 1993 called Big Toe?
All I wanna do is suck your big toe, suck it real slow.
That sketch spoofed romantic music videos with campy embellishments a hell of a lot better than, whatever this was in 1995.
Get ready, it's gonna be a long night.
Throw your clothes
on the floor.
On the floor.
I'm gonna take my clothes off too. I made plans to be with you.
Look, I'm sorry I had to spend such an inordinate long time talking about something that converted my brain into sea monkey powder, and it's a miracle that I still have the function of speech. So, before I forget how to walk and breathe like a human being, let's wrap this fucker up. In an effort to offer up some neutrality, as bad as season 20 was, there were still some beacons of effort that were sparsely scattered throughout the year. There were some great musical acts like R.E.M., Green Day, Dave Matthews Band, TLC, Bonnie Raitt, Rod Stewart, Bon Jovi, Annie Lennox, Seal, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Edie Brickell, Paul Simon, and the fucking Beastie Boys. What can I say? I love good music. Adam Sandler debuted the Hanukkah song that year. Molly Shannon joined the show mid-season to fill the gap left behind by Garofalo in her wake. And perhaps the most significantly, and maybe even the reason why people still tuned into the show by that point, the decision to make this man the new Weekend Update anchor.
A French man who calls himself the Snake Man was arrested this week after climbing up the side of a Manhattan high-rise. Yep, he climbed right up the side of a high-rise. Just like a snake.
But even those silver linings were merely bandages trying to patch up a sucking chest wound. Thanks in small part to the aforementioned whistleblowing by Janine Garofalo, coupled with the hit piece New York Magazine unleashed to the masses, SNL eventually got out of its midlife crisis by doing the one thing people in midlife crises do best, totally overhaul themselves to the point of being an almost completely different entity in an effort to eliminate the flaws that were hurting it and the people it affected. Gone were the well-established but burnt-out cast members. In came newcomers like Jim Brewer, Will Ferrell, Daryl Hammond, a few one-season wonders like David Koechner and Nancy Walls, the rise of popularity in Molly Shannon and Norm Macdonald, Tim Meadows' career renaissance after a stay of execution, and even David Spade staying behind just to be the cast's reluctant pillar of continuity. Gone were the writers who, with Jim Downey at the helm as head writer, pumped out subpar sketches for the sake of making a paycheck. In came Steve Higgins, fresh off producing The Jon Stewart Show in syndication and able to turn the remaining writers into a well-oiled machine again. Gone was director Dave Wilson, who, to be fair, simply retired and also called his own last shot on the show's 1995 finale. In came Beth McCarthy Miller, who, in her 10-year run, added some fresh perspectives to scene blocking, I assume. Gone, unfortunately, was G.E. Smith in the Saturday Night Live band, still one of the top 10 people ever to sling a guitar. And in came, well, nobody. Though Cheryl Hardwick, Lenny Pickett, and Leon Pendarvis continued to run the band with expert precision. Hardwick retiring in 2000, Pickett and Pendarvis are still there. Most importantly, gone was the Lorne Michaels that simply went through the motions while holding his glass of white wine, at least for the time being. I won't speak for how he's running things in this day and age, but for the 1995-96 season, he briefly dropped the executive from his producer title, something he did only one other time during season 12 when the calamities of that previous season needed to be fixed. And boy, did he.
It was all a dream. A horrible, horrible dream.
And you know what? He did his damnedest to keep everything on track once again by becoming more hands-on in the creative process just like he did in the first 5 years of the show. In fact, one of the most important things that Lorne, or quite possibly NBC, did during the summer was put on two separate month-long blocks of best-of shows from the second golden era. 1986 to 1990 during the summer reruns, and then 1990 to 93 later that fall as Mad TV was starting up on Fox. Those shows, and faith in the viewers that they would take these new changes very well, helped remind people once again why the show was worth watching. The show itself has seen its fair share of highs and lows since 1995. But even on nights when the show is clearly not worth watching, there's now more of a post-mortem damage control as to how to avoid those mistakes the following week. More often than not, the mistakes wind up correcting themselves, even quicker these days in the wake of social media and instant gratification. It's safe to say that after the perils of Season 20, Lorne Michaels and company, for the most part, has largely learned their lesson, even if they still have a lot of learning to do as the show approaches its 50th year on the air.
I think we all had a great time here on the first show of the 20th anniversary season of Saturday Night Live. Everybody, thanks a lot.
Next time on Telehell, after a show like this one, I will both vent and express my frustrations
through interpretive dance.
Kidding, kidding, kidding. Not that I'd be able to do so in audio form anyway. But our next subject does involve some dancing.
There's one night everyone wants to remember. This is a night no one could forget.
I'll have her back very early, say 6 or 7 a.m. Ciao.
I can't believe this is happening.
We're going to the prom.
This is deep.
And now, the lamps are in high gear when everyone hits the floor to dance till dawn.
Until then.
If it's not in Telehell, it's not worth a damn.
Special thanks to Andrew Dick of That Week in SNL for reminding me where exactly on the Internet Archive they stashed away every single episode of SNL. Sorry to have bugged you there, but it's been a chaotic few months behind the scenes for me, and I kind of needed to get my head on straight, so thanks again, bud. Telehell was written, produced, edited, and narrated by me, Justin Hart. All clips used in this program are protected under the Fair Use Doctrine of the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, and all clips used come courtesy of their respective companies and owners. Some of the music used in this program comes courtesy of YouTube and their audio library service. Telehell is a production of Horton Road and is distributed by Libsyn. You know that thing that people do in order to communicate with each other without actually having to look each other face to face? You know, social media? Well, we do that. Look for us on X, Facebook, and now Blue Sky. All three of them at Telehell Podcast. And don't forget to like, comment, rate, subscribe, and pretty much tell us what you think of our show everywhere that you can stream us. And also on our complaint line, telehellpodcast@gmail.com.